I'm going to be talking about something that may be a little bit out of the ordinary for this meeting, although given that the meeting hasn't really started yet, I guess the standard hasn't been set. But I'm going to be talking about work that in some way is cryptographically inspired, even if it isn't itself really about cryptography. And so basically the idea is that the kinds of things that one thinks about when one is doing cryptography turn out to be really crucial and central to understanding just basic questions about quantum information on its own without any reference to actually trying to do accomplish some cryptographic task. And so I'm going to start out by just refreshing your memories. Among the quantum information theorists, that probably isn't necessary, but maybe for the classical cryptographers in the audience will be helpful, to refresh your memories on Maxwell's demon and how it was ultimately resolved. And that's going to have a little, it's going to give us a moral with which to move forward in the rest of the talk. And I'm going to talk then about the importance of erasure when thinking about quantum information. And there are many, many applications of this, but I'll just sketch how one applies it in a couple of situations. One is thinking about the entanglement-assisted capacity of a quantum channel, and then moving on to some new work done with some students who are currently here today, Frédéric Dupuy and Yvonne Savoff, on capacities of broadcast channels. And then, towards the end, I'll just make some wild speculations about what all this might mean for real physical systems. So Maxwell's demon, what is that all about? So this is a situation where you have a gas that's originally at equilibrium, and then you have this little demon character, right? And what the demon does is he drops in a partition into that gas. He just puts it in the middle, okay? And what he does is he has a door in his partition, and when he sees a particle approaching from the left, he opens the door, lets it go through, but when he sees a particle approaching from the right, he leaves the door closed. And so over time, the number of particles on the right-hand side increases. Let's see how that works, right? Particles bouncing around. He sees one coming from the left, opens the door, particle goes through, and the door closes. Now, this doesn't seem like too much of a problem, maybe if you're a cryptographer, but from a physicist's point of view, this is a real problem because the entropy of the gas has decreased, right? This is somehow a non-equilibrium configuration. There are more particles on the right than there are on the left. And this was really a crisis. This, I don't know if it was necessarily a crisis, but this is a real difficulty for the foundations of statistical mechanics. Maxwell realized it was a problem more than 100 years ago, and really the solution stumped some really eminent physicists from Maxwell, von Neumann, Brillouin, Szilard. And most of them, in trying to understand what was going on here, they focused on the door. They figured that there must be, well, they focused on two things. One, they figured that there must be some irreducible cost to the demon in terms of learning about what the particles were doing. Maybe that was the source of the problem. Or maybe there was some irreducible cost to moving that door. Maybe that was the problem. And it turns out that in a careful analysis, neither of those things really ultimately have any kind of fundamental physical bound. The only thing that really matters, well, let's watch the animation again and see if we can identify it. So there's the door, particle coming, bouncing around. Now the key thing is that this demon, when he sees the particles approaching, or in order to actually respond to those particles as they come in, it actually has to be interacting with the particles and it has to be collecting information, right? And he has to process that information. The key point is that he actually has to have a finite memory, right? It's a finite device. He can't just collect information indefinitely forever in a reversible way. Eventually, he's going to run out of space in his memory and he's going to have to start forgetting things. And it turns out that is the solution to this Maxwell's demon paradox. It was identified by Bennett in 1982 using what's called Landauer's principle, that any time you forget a bit of information, that actually has an irreducible thermodynamic cost. It results in a heat being released to the environment. And so what's the moral here? Well, here was a pretty simple problem that, as you can see, ultimately has a pretty simple solution. But it vexed people for a very long time. It vexed people for over 100 years. And it turned out that the problem was really identifying erasure of information as the nexus, right, as the crucial as the crucial thing to think about. And so people could kind of get some insight into what was going on by looking at all these extraneous, ultimately extraneous phenomena, but it was erasure that was central. And that's the moral that I want to take moving forward, that in quantum information theory, There's a lot going on, but often actually you can boil everything down to thinking about erasure. Okay, so now another thing that's probably quite familiar to the quantum information theorists, but just to set the stage for any classical cryptographers around. In quantum information theory, most of us regularly attend the Church of the Larger Hilbert Space. And what that's about, if you have some quantum system, I'm going to represent them throughout the talk by this by a particle, round ball. When it goes to the Church of the Larger Hilbert Space, it gets a kind of an angel partner. We have a system A, it gets a system B, and they're correlated in some way. And the result, or rather the what you end up with is a pure state, what we'll call phi AB, for which the original state, rho A, is the reduction. So if you ignore the presence of this angelic partner up above, then you're just left with rho A. But the moral is that when you're faced with a mixed state in quantum mechanics, you can always just imagine that there's some other system lying around somewhere that you might not have access to, for which, when you put the two systems together, the overall state is pure. So that's basically the Church of the Larger Hilbert Space. Yes, and as you can see, as in all great world religions, rituals of purification play a crucial role at the Church of the Larger Hilbert Space as well. So purifications, this is sort of it seems like a technical point, but it's actually going to be absolutely crucial throughout the talk. They're all essentially equivalent in the sense that they're equivalent up to some local unitary transformation of this purifying space. Okay, so now let's move on to a slightly more complicated example, a pair of particles visiting the Church of the Larger Hilbert Space. So this is a pair of particles, rho A tensor rho sigma C, that are not correlated in any way, right? They're independent of each other. Their state is a tensor product. So if they both go to the Church of the Larger Hilbert Space, then you can just purify them individually, right? You can say for system A, we give this B, and we get a pure state there. And for system C, we provide a D, and we get a pure state there. And the overall state is just a tensor product, which we could call, in this case, the pure state phi AB, tensor product, the pure state psi BD. Nothing too exciting. But something else could happen. Oh, and of course, the condition, as before, is satisfied, that if you ignore the C and D particles, you're just left with the original tensor product state. So now, let's have those particles visit the Church of the Larger Hilbert Space again and see what else could happen. They visit the Church of the Larger Hilbert Space, and instead of purifying them individually, let's just purify them together, right? So we just say, well, there's a BD system, and we don't know if B and D are in a product state or if they're correlated. In general, they're correlated, right? And then... And so when A and C exit the church, right, then B and D purify them, as before. But all we know now is that there's some global pure state, C, A, B, C, D, for which... when we ignore the CD part, we get the tensor product. But that global pure state might not itself be a product, right? But now we can go back to that technical point from the previous slide. Purifications are essentially unique, right? Which means that we can write this C state as some unitary on the BD system, remember, because they're, all purifications are unique up to such a local unitary transformation, times the one that we saw in the previous slide, right? Because these are just two different purifications of the same state. And so that means that we could actually sort of act on the BD system and disentangle the particles, okay? So this is kind of a triviality. It's very, very simple, but my whole talk is just going to rest on the observation that you can always do this. And this talk is basically going to be telling you that a lot of what we care about in quantum information theory, you can actually just, as long as you keep this in mind, you can always sort of figure out what's going on. Oh, and of course, once we've acted on B and D, then the state is the tensor product, which is now U inverse acting on the state that we had before. Okay, so now on to forgetting. I would like to talk a little bit about how one forgets, what one does in quantum information theory to forget. And of course, this is not what we want to do. We want to forget as much as possible. So what I'm going to mean by forgetting for the rest of the talk, I'll just illustrate by this. Well, it's barely even an example, but So we have a situation where we have Alice and Bob. There are two participants. That I'm sure I don't need to explain to classical cryptographers. And in this particular case, Alice has one particle, Bob has three particles, and they're just correlated in some generic way that I've indicated using the green lines. So, So the question is, how can Bob unilaterally destroy his correlation with Alice, right? Well, there's a natural thing that he can do, right? He can just start throwing away particles. If he threw away all of his particles, then obviously he's destroyed his correlation with Alice, but that's not really very interesting. And so the real question is, how few particles can Bob throw away and still successfully just eliminate his correlation with Alice in this situation? So let's just try it out and see. Well, I'll call his particles B1, B2, and B3. He throws away B1, puts it in the trash. What has happened? Well, there apparently is still correlation, right? So that didn't do the job. So let's throw away the B3 particle. And lo and behold, in this particular case, if you threw away the B3 particle, then the reduced state on A and B2 is a tensor product. So that actually succeeded in eliminating all of the correlation. And so in this case, yeah, two particles were sufficient. Now, I'd like to actually do that again. From a slightly different point of view. So let's actually grab that trash bin, move it over, and instead of calling it the trash, which is kind of derogatory, let's call it Charlie's magical bucket of particles. And of course, now there's a third party, Charlie, who's actually going to be keeping track of that bucket, or at least keeping an eye on it. And the bucket actually starts out with one extra quantum system in it, which is the one that I'll call C. And that is the system that's going to purify both Alice and Bob's particles. Okay, so now we have a global pure state. And let's let Bob start discarding particles again. So he puts one in the magical bucket of particles. That hasn't succeeded in destroying the correlation between Alice and Bob. But we know if he throws B3 away, then that's actually going to eliminate all of the correlation. And now the only way that there's any sort of connection between Alice and Bob is through Charlie, right? So Charlie, this is exactly the situation that we saw in the Church of the Larger Hilbert space when two particles went in. The purification system is entangled in some way or is correlated in some way, but the particles held by Alice and Bob are not. And so we just recall what we learned about purifications when we visited the Church of the Larger Hilbert space, which is that all purifications are equivalent up to local unitary transformations, right? And so we can actually act on these particles to disentangle, or rather, Charlie alone can act on those particles to disentangle them. And the result is, of course, that Charlie now holds an uncorrelated purification of both Alice's particles and Bob's particles. Right? So he has pure state entanglement with Alice, and he has pure state entanglement with Bob in this process. Okay, so this is what I'm going to mean for the time being by erasure or forgetting in quantum mechanics. When you want to destroy correlations with some party, you discard particles. And if you view this from the point of view of the Church of the Larger Hilbert space, once you've done that, the purifying system can actually finish the job and completely disentangle sort of Alice's entanglement from Bob's entanglement in his laboratory. Okay, so we have a before and after picture. In the before picture, we just have some generic multi-party correlation between Alice, Bob, and Charlie. In the after picture, we have pure state entanglement between Alice and Charlie, and then other pure state entanglement between Bob and Charlie. Okay. Now, a key thing to note is that in this process that I described, Alice never did anything at all. She's entirely passive. And I guess for the sake of the cryptographers in the audience, I should say that while I call this Alice here, you might want to prefer to think of Alice as actually an adversary or an eavesdropper, right? You're actually destroying correlation with her. And she's in this case, she's passive. Her density operator remains unchanged through the process. And so phi A, the reduced density operator for the initial state, is the same as psi A, the reduced density operator for the final state. And so two things have happened here. As I said before, clearly we have, at the end, we have pure state entanglement between Alice and Bob, and between, or Alice and Charlie, and between Bob and Charlie. But because Alice's density operator never changed, what actually happened here is that Bob successfully transferred his correlation with Alice to Charlie, right? Because the purification of this of this system that Alice is holding was initially shared between the two of them. At the end of the protocol, it's held by Charlie alone. So this is like Bob successfully performing some kind of quantum communication to merge his state with Charlie's. Now, I said before, of course, the real question is how hard it is to do this, and I'll just give you some formulas. We're not going to talk too much about the proof of how you get there. In the special case where the state does have some structure, which is that you actually have many copies of some generic state between Alice, Bob, and Charlie, so now we have n copies of such a state, then the right quantities to think about are actually entropies. And so if we define the von Neumann entropy of a state rho on system A as what we call the von Neumann entropy of rho A, the density operator reduced to A, and that's minus the trace of rho A log rho A, then we can define this correlation measure, the mutual information. And of course, this is just the formal quantum analog of the mutual information that all of you are probably familiar with, entropy of A plus entropy of B minus the joint entropy. As for classical probability distributions, it has some excellent properties. In particular, it's zero if and only if A and B are completely uncorrelated. And it's maximal for EPR type states. So how many particles do we expect Bob to need to send to Charlie? Well, initially, Alice and Bob share some amount of mutual information, which is n times, because they're n states, the mutual information for a single copy of the state. Right? That's just kind of that comes from the definition. And at the end of the day, they want to have no correlation left, right? They want to forget everything. So they're actually, in my protocol, I let them fudge a little bit. They're not going to forget everything, but get it down to some really small epsilon. And so they have to start here and end here. Now, as I said, this mutual information is maximal for singlets. And so the most that a single qubit can carry away is 2 bits of correlation. And so if you start at n times mutual information, you want to go to zero, and each qubit can send 2, well, you'd say, well, if in an ideal world, we would hope that Bob could get away with only sending n times mutual information divided by 2 particles. And that's essentially correct. It turns out that you can do this. And of course, if you're going to do this, how do you actually choose, how does Bob choose which particles to send? And this is actually crucial for some parts, or at least for the end of the talk. Bob, what does he have to do? How does he choose which particles to discard? You can just choose them at random. And what I mean by random in this particular case is that he restricts to the high probability subspace. Like this is just like in classical information theory, restricting to typical strings. And on there, he applies a random unitary transformation according to the unitarily invariant measure. And then he just sends any particles. It doesn't matter which ones. And so what's interesting about this is that in order to optimally forget, in order to optimally destroy those correlations, Bob can actually essentially completely ignore the correlation structure of his state. It doesn't matter what's there. And again, this point is going to recur, so keep it in mind. Okay, so the final accounting, the investment, the amount of work that needs to be done, Bob needs to send n times this mutual information between Alice and Bob qubits to Charlie. And at the end of the day, the rewards, well, we saw that Charlie's going to hold a purification of Alice's state, and then Bob and Charlie are also going to actually have a bunch of EPR pairs, a bunch of singlets. And the question is how many? It turns out that the answer is n times the mutual information between Bob and Charlie in the initial state over 2. So that's kind of satisfying because you would like the amount of correlation they end with to somehow depend on the amount they start with, and that's exactly the conclusion. They end up with exactly essentially the amount of correlation that they started with, so nothing is wasted. Yeah. Okay, so I've sort of given you this long song and dance about the power of forgetting and how one forgets and how hard one needs to work in order to forget, but what good is all this, right? What can you actually learn about quantum information by understanding this process? So a few years ago, the situation in quantum information theory, quantum Shannon theory, I should say, was a little bit discouraging. It wasn't discouraging, but there was a lot. We knew some things, and every new thing we learned seemed to require an awful lot of work. And then along came Igor Devitak, Andreas Winter, who's here, and Aram Perro, and they noticed that a lot of the things that we'd like to do in quantum information theory are closely related to each other. And they proposed 2 protocols. They called them the mother and the father. And from the mother, if you were given some noisy quantum correlated state, you could do certain good things with it. Like you could, it told you how to construct the optimal entanglement distillation protocol, for example, or the optimal way to teleport using that noisy state, or the optimal way to superdense code using that noisy state. On the other side, there was this protocol called the father, and that told you how to deal with noisy quantum channels. If you wanted to send, if you wanted to take a noisy quantum channel and send data through it reliably, then this father protocol sort of told you how to do that. It gave you the entanglement assisted capacities, the regular quantum capacity, and so on. And so this was a great simplification. But there was a big question left after they solved this was, well, what about this mother and the father? Why are there two separate families in all of this? And it turns out there aren't. That this forgetting that I've been telling you about actually links these two families to each other. And so that's actually that's quite gratifying. And it turns out that the way it links, well, the way that the mother is linked to forgetting is actually the mother is essentially forgetting. Once we take the original mother protocol from that paper, which we don't need to know, and we look at it in the from the point of view of the Church of the larger Hilbert space. On the right-hand side, I am going to tell you about how this works. You can somehow exploit the symmetry of bipartite quantum states, in particular Schmidt symmetry, to get from one to the other. But actually, this is not all you get. If you were interested in doing what Charlie Bennett calls the Homer-Simpson task, which is simulating quantum channels optimally, that's actually running forgetting backwards in time. And we won't have time to talk about that, but it's quite interesting. If you wanted to do distributed compression of correlated quantum states, that's actually another task you can get from here. And Ivan Savov, who's another student of mine who's here today, has some interesting results on that if you would like to talk to him. Something called state merging, which appeared in Nature last summer and was by Horodetsky, Oppenheim, and Winter, is also follows very, very directly from here. If you have now, if you move into the context where you're interested in using quantum channels that have many inputs and many outputs optimally for communication, it turns out that is also very directly solved by this forgetting task. And so the capacity of channels that have many inputs and one output, so think of like many cell phones trying to communicate to a base station, quantum mechanically, of course, solving that problem comes in here. Or if you have the reverse problem of a base station trying to communicate with many cell phones, that's the broadcast type capacities, that falls into this context. And finally, even the simulation of these broadcast type channels, it turns out that this forgetting type task gives us an optimal way to do that as well. And I ran out of space on the board, so that's as much as I'll show you. So I'd like to emphasize, Ivan Savov has some nice results over here. Frédéric Dupuy has really been pushing this quantum broadcast channels work. And so if you have more questions about this, I encourage you to talk to him. Okay. And so, because there's so many things on the board here, and we have a limited amount of time, I'm only going to tell you about two of them. And that's, first I'm going to show you how to somehow make this connection between forgetting and sending data through quantum channels, and then I'm going to move on to this new stuff, which is the broadcast channel capacities. So entanglement-assisted communication. First, I'm just going to sort of set up the context so you know what we're up to. So here we have three systems, essentially. We have a reference, who will come into play in a moment. We have Alice and we have Bob. And we have a noisy channel from Alice to Bob, so I'll just indicate that by an N, A prime to B. This is going to be the A prime system, the B system. And so we can communicate through that channel from Alice to Bob. And it's entanglement-assisted communication, so we're going to think about the situation where Alice and Bob initially share some entanglement. So that's what's indicated here. Of course, for those of you who aren't familiar with these diagrams, time is moving from left to right. And somehow these green lines indicate quantum information propagating noiselessly. So we have entanglement between Alice and Bob. And we're also going to have entanglement between the reference and Alice. And of course, the goal in this, because I'm saying we're going to try to accomplish entanglement-assisted communication, I'm interested in entanglement-assisted quantum communication, which means that Alice should be able to send arbitrary quantum states to Bob. And it's good enough to just verify that Alice can send an arbitrary large entangled state to Bob. That's sort of the standard result of quantum information theory. So the reference is going to check that. And so if we're going to have a protocol here, of course, Alice needs to perform some kind of encoding, right? And she encodes her half of the entanglement with Bob and her half of this reference system. It goes through the channel, and at the output, Bob has to perform some kind of decoding. And the goal is, of course, to establish pure state entanglement between Bob and the reference at the end of the day. Right? If we can do that, if we can send that reference entanglement successfully to Bob, then we have succeeded at this entanglement-assisted quantum communication. And I should say that from this result, one gets entanglement, essentially unassisted communication as well, and all kinds of other good things. Now, in this box originally I had a noisy channel, but the message from the beginning, or one of the messages from the beginning of the talk, is that we should always try to work in the Church of the larger Hilbert space. And so here I'm going to think of this noisy quantum channel as being a unitary transformation followed by to not just Bob, but Bob in an environment system, and then discarding the environment system. So I'm going to keep the environment around. So how do we accomplish this entanglement-assisted quantum communication using the forgetting task? Well, presumably we have to forget something, right? So what needs to be forgotten here? If you remember from the previous slide, the goal is to establish pure state entanglement between the reference and Bob, which means that we have to forget any correlations between the reference and the environment, right? That is what we need to achieve in this task, destroying any correlations between the reference and the environment, which means, because we're working in the Church of the larger Hilbert space, that all of the reference's correlation must be sitting in Bob's system. And I've just indicated that here. If we can really succeed in decorrelating the reference and the environment, then because all the other particles are held by Bob, Bob can actually disentangle those completely and succeed in getting the reference entanglement out. Now, of course, how are we going to do this? Well, we could just try to do exactly what we did when we were studying forgetting before, which is to apply a random unitary transformation on these two systems here. So essentially, we want to forget correlations between the reference and the environment. And you can imagine that we join B2, which is the Bob's half of his entanglement shared with Alice, and the reference system, and you shrink down the amount of data that you're trying to send through the channel, and you increase the amount of entanglement that Alice and Bob share. The more you do this, the easier it is to forget that correlation. And so if you just choose a random unitary transformation here, at some point, the more entanglement Bob has, because the amount of entanglement Bob has here is essentially how many particles are being discarded at the output of this unitary transformation, the number left in the reference, if they're sufficiently small, if there are sufficiently few particles left in the reference system, then after a random unitary transformation, they'll be decoupled from the environment. That's all well and good. So we could use a random unitary transformation on this B2 system and the reference to decouple those systems. But the problem is, this doesn't fit into the picture on the previous slide at all, right? Because the picture on the previous slide, we have an encoding by Alice, then we need a decoding by Bob. But this transformation acts not on Bob's system, but on one of Bob's systems and the reference on the environment, or on the reference system. So this isn't even permitted, right? This isn't allowed in the picture. But luckily, what we can do here, we can exploit the symmetry of bipartite quantum states. Here we have some entanglement, pure state entanglement shared between Bob and Alice. And here we have other pure state entanglement shared between Alice and the reference. And we all know that acting on one half of a maximally entangled state is essentially the same thing as acting on the other half. So we can take that V and move it to the other half and act with a transpose. In this way, we actually move from forgetting to something that looks like a protocol that one can use for entangled assisted communication. And I'll just tell you that if you do this, this actually gives you the optimal protocols for succeeding at this task. All right. So I hope the gist of that was clear. I'm going to move on now to a slightly more complicated scenario, which is actually using this to communicate through broadcast channels. Now, a broadcast channel is just a channel with one input and multiple outputs. And for simplicity, I'm going to deal with the case here where we have one input and only two outputs. And so we have a Bob 1 and a Bob 2. And so we're going to have a reference 1 and a reference 2, one for the communication that Alice is going to try to accomplish with Bob 1, and another one for the communication Alice is going to try to accomplish with Bob 2. All right, and so let's just try to set this up again. First, just as before, it's convenient not to deal with the noisy channel, but with its unitary extension. So we'll drop in an environment system and then make sure that everything is pure. We're going to talk about entangled assisted communication. And so there's going to be entanglement between Alice and the first Bob, and entanglement between Alice and the second Bob. And I'm just going to call these, I'm going to label these systems P1 and P2 for pre-shared entanglement. And in addition, there's going to be entanglement between the reference and Alice, or reference 1 and Alice, and reference 2 and Alice. And the goal is going to be for Alice to successfully send the entanglement with reference 1 to Bob 1, and the entanglement with reference 2 to Bob 2. Okay? And we could try to do exactly what we did on the previous slide, which is to apply random unitary transformations on the reference and the on Bob 1's half of the entanglement and the reference 2 and Bob 2's half of the entanglement. But we should look at this and think for a moment, because our question is, who needs to do the forgetting again? And in this case, because we want at the output reference 1 to be decoupled with everything, it has to be decoupled with everything at the output. So it has to be decoupled with the environment. It has to be decoupled with both of these systems on P2, and likewise the other way around. So let's just try to play the same trick. We have pure state entanglement, and so we can move these unitary transformations from one half to the other. And what have we succeeded in doing then? Well, these unitary transformations will successfully decouple reference 1 from the environment and reference 2 from the environment, but they don't actually do any good in terms of decoupling, say, reference 2 from pre-shared entanglement 1. And so there's actually the need in this particular case for an extra step, which is another random unitary transformation acting in some way after the input. And what you do is you take the output, you're discarding particles, again you're trying to forget, and what you're trying to do in this particular case is forget any correlation between the two Alices. And so the output of this random unitary transformation just becomes more environment, we'll say. In any case, this kind of thinking does lead, again, to the optimal protocol, well, I should say, to what are conjectured to be the optimal protocols for communicating through broadcast channels. And the structure of the kinds of rates you can achieve look like this. So if you have any input state to the channel with an Alice 1 input, an Alice 2 input, and then an Alice prime, which is the input system, and then you act by the channel transformation, taking Alice prime to a Bob 1, a Bob 2 in an environment, then you can achieve any rate of quantum communication from Alice to each of the Bobs, so a rate of Q1 to Bob 1 and Q2 to Bob 2, provided certain inequalities are satisfied. And those inequalities are these here. These rates are just saying that you can't actually achieve more than you would achieve using a non-broadcast type channel. And then the sum rate, this should be Q1 plus Q2, looks like saying, well, you can't achieve more than you would achieve with two independent channels minus a piece that somehow depends on how correlated the input state was. And so that extra transformation where we had to sort of simulate being, where we had to decouple the two inputs results in a penalty. What's interesting in this is that this has exactly the same form as what is in classical information theory called Martone's region. So even in classical information theory, we don't know the optimal rates at which you can communicate through a broadcast channel. And the best known region is called Martone's region, and it's conjectured to be optimal, no one knows. And so now we know that we can actually at least do as well in the quantum mechanical setting, although we don't know that you can't do better. All right, so now I'm going to move on to, for the last couple of minutes, some wild speculation that doesn't really have too much to do with information, but has to do with how one can apply these notions of forgetting in quantum information now to potentially real physical systems, or at least caricatures of real physical systems. And so now I'm going to have a system B, which is this, I'm not going to specify what it is, but it's some quantum system B, and we imagine that it's radiating particles. Okay, so you can imagine that it's some great big star or something. It's radiating away. And now we have an Alice. Okay, and Alice, in her laboratory, she prepares two quantum systems that are entangled in some way. And what she does is she drops one of them into that radiating system. Okay, So now we have an A and a B. And the question is, how long does Alice need to wait until the information about A escapes from that from that quantum system B, right? This is essentially the same question as I've been asking through my whole talk. I guess in my talk I've had an A system, a B system, and a C system. So I should say that the C system is going to be all those radiated particles, right? The question is, how long does it take before those radiated particles actually contain the purification of the A system? And what we've actually seen here is that provided the internal dynamics of the B system are very mixing, right? So provided there's something like a random unitary transformation, you don't actually have to wait long at all. Once that internal dynamics has implemented a unitary transformation, the first particle to come out actually carries away the correlation for you, okay? So that might seem a little bit surprising, because of course this is quantum mechanics and we can't clone, right? So you might say, well, it must be one specific one of those particles that comes out that carries the information about Alice's system, but that's actually incorrect, right? It can come out in any one of those particles, provided you use the other particles to help reconstruct the purification. Now, what I'm really getting at here is maybe the wild speculation part of the talk. Can cryptography, or at least cryptographic ideas, tell us anything or help us in any way in thinking about black hole evaporation? And so there's a big question. This is one of those great big open problems in physics. For those of you who aren't familiar with it, I'll just go through it. So let's imagine that initially we have a pure state, okay? And that pure state, we have essentially C, which is going to be the rest of the universe, and B, which is a black hole, right? So there's a Hilbert space with a tensor product structure. Now, a black hole is not actually completely black. Stephen Hawking discovered that it actually radiates. And so, at least in certain space-times, that black hole will evaporate. It will shrink over time. Oh, it was curtailed. So, as it radiates particles, it loses mass, and eventually it shrinks away to nothing. And so we can see at time zero, there was C and B. At time T2, there's radiation left in the universe, but there's no black hole. And there's the question, is that final state pure or mixed? Because the black hole radiation, those particles that come off, are actually, as far as the calculation goes, highly entangled with the interior of the black hole. But if the interior disappears, if there's nothing left, then the question is, well, did the dynamics of the system actually evolve a pure state initially to something mixed? Was information destroyed? And this is, of course, a serious question for physics. The real question is the final state of the universe pure or mixed? But what we've been learning today is actually it could be very interesting to ask an intermediate question, which is the final state of some particular radiated particle pure or mixed, right? And this is actually a different question, that if you circle one of those particles and call it A, you could, actually there's no need to wait until the black hole is completely evaporated. We could put it back in, so we have a system B, and the system C is everything else. And then we can ask the question, is system A purified by C? And it certainly isn't required that the black hole be completely evaporated in order to answer this question. And the global state of A and C can be highly mixed, even though the purification of A would have escaped. And this is essentially some manifestation of the observation that quantum error correction is possible, that information can leak out of the black hole reliably, even though there would be a lot of noise in the system. And if the internal dynamics is sufficiently mixing, then it essentially naturally generates error-correcting codes. Whether that actually happens for real or not, who knows? But I think it's an interesting question that, as far as I know, hasn't really been asked yet. And just to make things even stranger, there's nothing special about the particular Alice the particular particle that I labeled as A the first time. I could have labeled another radiated particle as A, so I could have an A, an A2, an A3, an A4. And in fact, I could collect all of the particles that are emitted, label them all as A's, due to concentration of measure effects in the unitary group, it is possible for every single one of them to be purified by the rest of the universe simultaneously, even though the overall state would be mixed. So there are certainly situations here that I think seem highly paradoxical, but are at least possible in principle. All right, so I hope I've given you some idea of how central this, I feel at least, that this idea of forgetting, destroying correlation is for quantum information. You can use it to organize a lot of what we know about asymptotic quantum information theory. If we're lucky, we can actually use some of the lessons that we've learned to learn something about real physics. A paper detailing at least the first half of what I talked about today is available on the archive. That's joint work with Anura Abeyasinghe, Igor Devitak, and Andreas Winter. And as I said, the work on the more multi-party, on the multi-party scenarios is with my PhD, or my students who are here today, Frédéric Dupuis and Yvonne Sapoff. So I encourage you to talk to them.